Hey, Derek here. Today's episode is going to be about Flann O'Brien. We're looking forward to it. Before we go on, I just want to say for those of our listeners who are living in the Republic of Ireland, please do make sure that you are registered to vote in the upcoming referendum. You have until May the 8th to register if you are not currently on the register. It only takes a minute. Visit checktheregister.ie. Give it a go. If your name has a father or a apostrophe in it, just check it with and without it if it doesn't go first time. And now the show. From Headstuff Studios in Dublin, welcome to Mother Folklore, a podcast about words, Irish words, and words from Ireland. I'm Derek O'Shea. I'm joined today by Shuan. Shuan's back.
Hello.
How are you getting on, Shuan?
I'm very well. How are you?
I am doing okay.
Good.
Who is your favourite writer stroke civil servant, apart from me?
Flann O'Brien, for very many reasons, and not because of his civil service status, probably.
Yes, indeed. Flann O'Brien, I'm sure most of our listeners will be familiar with him in one or the other of his three names. Mm-hmm. Brian O'Nolan, the name that the priest poured water on. Mm-hmm. Miles na Gcopaleen, the name that he used for his Irish language work and for some of his journalism. And Flann O'Brien, which he used mostly for his novels.
Mm. He actually used hundreds of names, I think, over the columns and in letters to the Irish Times. And in fact, a new book has just come out last week on Flann O'Brien's letters, which is a huge book. I didn't think it would be so big. It looks amazing, by a lecturer called Maeve Long. And I've just gotten a copy, so it looks really great.
I'd be really eager to see that. Mm. One of the things that really interested me, and obviously Flann is a writer I relate to in a lot of ways, is he got his big break, or part of his big break with his journalism, certainly, from effectively writing smart alecky letters to the editor, who was Bertie Smiley at the time, of the Irish Times. And with this, the letters to the editor page would have been the Twitter feed of its time. And his work got such a great response that it led to him starting a writing career.
Yeah, it was basically UGC, user generated content. He started to write so much that they couldn't keep him out of the paper. And mm-hmm. people had started, as you say, it was like Twitter, people had started to follow his correspondence in the paper. So much so that he began to write forward and back to himself under different pen names, and nobody was ever sure which ones were Flann O'Brien and which ones weren't, because there were so many names and he seemed to agree and disagree with himself from one end of the day to the next. So eventually Bertie Smiley just said, look, we'll give him a column.
And that column was called?
Cruiskeen Lán, and spelled phonetically, so not spelled as it would be Oscaidige, but Asperla. Mm. And that's something that Flann O'Brien did a lot of, was he used Irish. Irish was his first language, but he used to speak or write in Irish, but used the English alphabet. And, you know, it was kind of a dig at the Jeckeens in Dublin, who mm. were, you know, romanticising the West and becoming more Gaelic by the day. And I think as a native speaker, it was something he became really frustrated with, mm. that maybe the Gael was misunderstood. Or this over-romanticisation, as I say, just really started to grate on him. So it's something that he really pushed against.
And he was a real outsider. And obviously because he was born in what became the north of Ireland.
Yeah, in Strabane, County Tyrone.
And this wasn't one of the designated Gaeltacht areas when the designated Gaeltacht areas happened. And so that he was aware there was this Gaeltacht cult, but that he wasn't a part of those Gaeltachts, but he wasn't a part of Dublin either.
Yeah, I think that's something that we can really see throughout all his work as well, is there's a little bit of a missing when it comes to the sense of belonging. And you can see that it's something that he eventually enjoys and celebrates in his writing, that he can hop between both and that he can take the piss out of both, basically, mm-hmm. English speakers and Irish speakers. But I think it has to have had something to do with being brought up as his first language being Irish, but also not being brought up in the place where, as you say, that's where the Gaeltacht was put on maps, whether that was right or wrong at the time. I think he felt like a little bit disjointed, and he didn't spend his whole life in Tyrone either. He came to Dublin and his dad died when he was pretty young, and he eventually got the job in the civil servants because there were 10 younger siblings than him and one older sibling, and he became the breadwinner.
That's right. And I mean, he came to Dublin as a secondary school student on a scholarship to Blackrock when the man who had become Archbishop McQuaid was headmaster.
Yeah. He didn't have a great effect on him, I'd say.
I think it may have given him a view of authority figures. But I think certainly he probably didn't see himself as ending up in the civil service.
No. Mm-hmm. No, I'd say had the dream been realised, he would have been a full-time writer and maybe been like other writers of his era and moved abroad and been able to write more freely. Because remember, the time that he was writing was a time of censorship and a time of conservatism in Ireland. And it was something that he really rallied against. Mm-hmm. But of course, there wasn't a whole lot he could do about it. He really pushed the boundaries with things. And in fact, at one point, he did say that any good writer worth his salt had at least one book banned. Mm-hmm. Sadly, he didn't make it onto that list. But he did enjoy somebody who really rebelled against authority. And that's something we see not only in the content of the books, but even the way he writes and in the columns as well. He doesn't even stick to one narrative.
Yeah.
At Swim starts with three different openings. He plays around with phonetics, as I said. The letters page has moved from one, or his correspondence in the Irish Times didn't even stay in one page. It often began on one page and ended on another. He would try and push the boundaries when it came to narrative and style as well. So I think authority was something that he really played around with.
Yeah. And thinking of his relationship with authority, I think something we've spoken about before is someone had said that in whenever there's a political scandal in England, they typically say it's just out of Orwell. Mm-hmm. But our political story like that in Ireland typically is just out of Flann O'Brien or just out of Miles de Gaeplein. And it shows that kind of in some ways they are opposite figures, but they've it does show that the actual attitude to authority one of our great anti-authoritarian writers had this absurdist take rather than the extremely, I guess, on the nose kind of and Orwell's such a tidy writer, such like a writer who doesn't like any big words when they can be put down. And,
yeah, absurd is something that Flann really excelled at. Yeah. I think he did it so much so that he began to show Ireland a version of itself that it didn't necessarily see before. And some of the audience really disliked what he was writing because it was uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And some people absolutely loved it and became loyal followers, especially of the column.
And again, thinking of how he would have acted in the Twitter age, one of the regular features in his column, and there are regular kind of sub-features in them, and if you're too scared to read Assume Two Birds and maybe you don't want to go straight in there, I would really recommend the best of Flann O'Brien journalism, the Cruise King Long Columns, is a very accessible way in. Mm. And one of the recurring features in his articles was the plain people of Ireland. And this always reminds me of the kind of replies you might get on Twitter from people who don't completely get what you're at.
Yeah.
You want to tell us more about those lads?
What it really reminds me of, the column, is Waterford Whispers. Yeah. And Beilbocht does the same because it's satire, but it's not necessarily even satire in one way. He literally covered both sides. He would satirize one group of people and then the next day might go against the next. So my slant is always, I look at the Irish language section. So he really had a go at Gaeilge Gardaí.
Yeah.
So those who weren't brought up speaking Irish, but learnt Irish and then became very obsessive and became Níos Gaeilge na na Gaeilge Thane. But then by the same token, he would also have a go at the people who lived in the Gaeltacht and say that they were living in muck and pigs and debauchery and all that. So, you know, he covered both angles when it came to satire. And I think that's a sign of a good satirist, that, you know, you're not necessarily biased, that you can be as horrible to both groups as possible.
There was bad on both sides, Sean.
That's the kind of guy he was, I think.
I think that he could be like that sometimes, but I think the scale, I think there was a lot of low cunning in the Gaeltacht and a lot of kind of very mean-spirited out to, you know, realising that a small opportunity, like a bunch of Southside Dublin Gaelgory arriving to town, was an opportunity to make some money fast that might not come again, which is very different from the lavish pretentiousness of some Gaelgory.
Yeah.
And which, I mean, apparently happens, but I think it's the big thing was he didn't feel he completely belonged to either group, and I imagine that his both sides thing never covered, he never considered himself to be on either side.
Yeah. Yeah, and I suppose that gave him the freedom as well to kick both sides, because I suppose maybe he didn't feel a loyalty, whereas other people feel like they couldn't possibly turn against their own, whereas he fell between the two. Mm-hmm. I think he gave himself the space. I'm not going to say he made many friends out of it.
No.
He wasn't a figure that was as we imagine the Irish writer, one of these, you know, performative, I'm so fun, I'll read for you now. Mm-hmm. He was a man who liked going to the pub, all right. But yes. That did not end well.
It didn't end. It seemed to start before he actually had achieved much in writing.
Mm-hmm.
And his writing career is fairly doomed as well, almost from the start. A big thing was he had the very misfortune of publishing his book in a London publisher in 1939.
Mm. Yeah, so the war started and that really affected the book. And then after that, a load of the books got burnt in a fire.
Yeah.
And like, it's kind of funny, I have to say, when I think about it, my dark humour makes me laugh at him. But, you know, this was his real work of art. And it was absolutely fecked from the start because of those two things over which he had no control.
Mm-hmm.
And The Third Policeman wasn't published until after his death. He did bring it to a publisher, but it was rejected. And that's something that he really didn't take very well.
That's right, because this is the 50th anniversary of his posthumous publication. Mm. And it is something that he really wasn't appreciated in his lifetime at all. And the fact that I imagine in his civil service career, he was always hoping that he'd somehow get discovered. I imagine he was, and you do detect this in his writing sometimes, really jealous of being able to live abroad and occasionally flashing the German, flashing the French.
Yeah.
Some of his work contains trilingual puns.
Yeah. Yeah. So some of his work takes work to read it.
Yeah.
It certainly isn't the most accessible at Swim and The Third Policeman. And Béal Bocht actually is really easy to read.
Yes.
But the English stuff isn't as easy to read. And I think the columns are much easier to read than the longer texts. But yeah, his puns are complicated, some of them. Now, other ones are pretty basic and they're kind of slapsticky. But yeah, no, he went into complex and went into great detail when he came to what we call Imrithis Fuckle.
He had a regular series called Keats and Chapman. Mm. And if you were to pick up a copy of The Best of Flann O'Brien in a bookshop, and you could go straight to this section, just to give yourself a little taste of what it's like. And there is these two short stories about Keats and Chapman, the poets, which all basically build up to a gargantuanly over-derivative pun. And it's as great as I think it's fantastic.
Yeah.
Some people might find it and hard work, but it is great.
Yeah, he was a genius. He was a genius. And I think that he could see the acknowledgement that people like Joyce and Beckett got, who were around his ear as well, but who escaped Ireland and escaped what he couldn't.
Yeah.
And I think he gives them a good go as well in many of the columns. And it's hard to tell whether it's like, it's not very affectionate.
No.
So I wonder, is it jealousy that they got away and he didn't? And he had to stick with this civil service.
It is. And he wouldn't have been conscious of the physical hardships that Joyce put his young family through in the process of, especially writing Finnegan's Wake at that stage. And similarly, the hardships that Beckett would have put himself through in the French Resistance and so forth, because he would have just been thinking about the misery of being unappreciated.
Yeah, his Béal Bocht.
Yeah, having to go drinking with Paddy Kavanagh.
Can you imagine two more miserable men? He used to drink in the Palace. That was his big one in Dublin.
That's right. He was a regular in the Palace.
But yeah, I love his work. And it's something that I always return to. And I think, as you said, Darragh, it's the columns specifically are something that you can dip in and out of. Mm. And most of what's written in them are still relevant and are still funny. Yeah. And I think that's something that really stands up, you know, to the test of time. His columns are particularly excellent. His novels really didn't get discovered until much later on.
Yeah.
And with all the furore about Joyce and Beckett, I think he was another modernist who didn't get added into the canon until later. I suppose there's many reasons why. But I if I were to choose something for a reader to begin with, I'd probably pick the columns.
Hmm. Something I found when I first discovered Flann in, when I was about 15 or 16, was that he had been such an influence on, I felt I already knew him because he'd been such an influence on comedy I'd already known.
Mm.
Specifically, obviously, Dave Allen, whose comedy specials we'd seen, his Dave Allen's father would have been an assistant editor or on the board in the Irish Times when Flann was there. And that similar kind of, that very irreverent, but kind of officially polite but fundamentally irreverent humor was definitely, he said himself, was very Flann inspired.
Mm.
And most of all, Terry Wogan had said that his Eurovision commentary, the idea of officially commenting on an event but using it to basically talk about completely different things, or the idea that someone's been put in charge who really shouldn't be in charge and they're just getting away with it because they're a little posh, was very flantastic.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. And I think we laugh. There's a conference that happens every second year, the International Flann O'Brien Conference. And when we're there, I've been there twice, we call ourselves the Flannaracs. There's many a good name to be called. But one thing that really stands out for me is when you do go to these conferences, they're not like other conferences. They're not like Joycean conferences, or they're not like conferences on, I don't know, the famine or whatever, anything. Yeah. They're fun. And the people who are there often really want to have a laugh in their papers. Now, a few of them are fairly serious stuff as well, but it's certainly more sprinkled with humour than other conferences on literary figures were. And I like that. I think that he would have liked that, don't take yourself too seriously.
When do they take place?
In the summer. So Ooh. There was one on last year, so I don't think there'll be one on this year. It's every second year. And there are three lecturers in Austria, one of them's in Italy, I think, who organise it. And it's always abroad, because I think they didn't want to put it in Ireland because they wanted just a fresh take on Flann O'Brien.
So
they got lots of international speakers that the first year, and they've just continued on. It's great.
One aspect that I really like to talk about is that it's part of his enduring legacy. Every Irish boy or girl who wants to write a book, they tell their parents they want to be a writer. Their mammy, or maybe even their daddy, will say, you know, you make sure you get a nice, sensible day job, possibly in the civil service, like Flann O'Brien did. And this might be his enduring legacy, in that he has become just like people tell their daughters, if you want to be an actress, go to college first, like Emma Watson, Natalie Portman did.
Yeah.
And similarly, if you want to be a writer, you make sure to get a nice, sensible day job, like Flann O'Brien did.
Like you, Darragh.
Like me, absolutely. And it's a tough beat trying to finish a second book while also trying to work a full-time job and also have a family. But, you know, I mean, you get one shot at life. You got to pack as much stuff in as you can.
Yes.
But what I was thinking was, and we spoke about this in Galway, the Kirch Festival recently. Do you think the conditions of being a full-time civil servant affected his writing? Would he have been a very different writer if he had been in the Chelsea Hotel in New York, or if he had been basically in Montmartre smoking cigarettes and sipping coffees?
Yeah, I think that whole area of his life moved into his writing. And I don't know whether he did it unconsciously or not, but I think there's a frustration. And I think, again, we go back to how he writes about other writers.
Yeah.
He really has a go at them. And Joyce is one of those ones that he had a go at particularly. And it's funny because apparently At Swim was the last book that James Joyce ever read before he died. So I think Flann O'Brien would have got a laugh out of that. But yeah, I think eventually at the end of Brennan Nolan's career in the civil service, he was asked to leave. At the beginning, I think he was given a little bit of freedom. They weren't sure at the very start if it was him or not writing in the column. And then eventually became a kind of an open secret.
Yeah.
And his satire became sharper and sharper. And I think he was having a right go at a few politicians. And so eventually he was asked to leave. And I don't know whether his drinking problems or whatever had an effect as well. But I think, I don't know if he would have been the same writer. And I think part of the loveliness in his writing and the absolute mystique of his writing is in the frustration.
Yeah.
But then we're divorcing the writer from the person, because I feel sorry for him. You know, it's horrible to be stuck in a job that he probably never wanted.
Yeah.
And trying to, you know, support this family and, you know, maybe very unhappy.
And we can compare him in some ways to a near contemporary of his who was also a Northern Irish, from Northern Ireland, from a poor background, who became a civil servant and wrote on the side. And that man was T.K. Whittaker. And he would have been the very much reverse, in that he had excelled in civil service career, kept his writing largely to a hobby, even though it is some very fine poetry. It didn't. He kept the job first. He did great things.
Yeah,
and
Brian Nolan took the road less taken there.
Very much so. Yeah, maybe T.K. Whittaker is the role model rather than
I think so.
Rather than Brian Nolan.
I think Brian Nolan's the underbelly of T.K. Whittaker.
But that's right. Yeah, it's like the two sides of the same coin.
Jekyll and Hyde of the civil servant.
But I do think that the restrictions that are put on civil servants as writers, which are effectively that You're not allowed to join political parties, mm-hmm. and there's a certain cautions need to be taken with addressing political issues that are kind of up for live elections and so mm-hmm. forth. But it may have caused him to be subtle in a way that he may not have felt a need to be if he was looking at Ireland over his shoulder from Barcelona or someplace. And that's in that subtlety, great art lies.
Absolutely, yeah. And in, as you said earlier, the trilingual puns, mm-hmm. some of the harshest jokes in his books are the best hidden ones. And unless you knew what he was talking about, I'd say a lot of it we skim over now and we don't really realise. I think some of it, when we look back, we nearly have to read it in parallel with Irish history.
Yes.
Because the digs are often at contemporaries or what's actually happening in Ireland at the time in 1940 or whatever. I think a lot of it is tied into societal issues.
This is especially true of The Brother, the recurring series of which it revolves around two men in a bar, one of whom appears to be Flann, highly well-spoken, sophisticated, very moderate in his views, and another who's a traditional Dublin man who's in digs with his brother and a number of other characters. And he recounts the events of the previous week. But a lot of these events refer to things that were in the news at the time. Mm. And while you can still read them, then they work without those contemporary references. Obviously, they benefit enormously from those contemporary references.
Mm. Yeah, and I think, The Brother is one that I really loved as well, because again, you can dip in and out of it, and it was one of those characters that he actually kept for a long time.
Yeah.
And there were a few of those, there were others that flitted in and out and only appeared maybe once, and I know, I can't remember the name of the scholar who was studying it, but they were actually trying to cross-reference all the names, how many times they appeared, when, why.
Yeah.
Because the naming thing is so important in his essence as an author. Mm-hmm. Why did he write as Miles na Gcapallín when he was a journalist, and why was he never Brian O'Nolan?
This is the thing, and back at the time it's relaxed since, but at the time if you were a civil servant and you wanted to write, and there were a fair few of them, you generally had to use a different name. The idea was that, as understandably so, that say if you were maybe sending out a letter that was bad news, or you were a comment, or you were putting a position paper, that it wouldn't be traceable to your opinions as a writer. Mm. And we do have, there was Martin O'Deerean was one of the, I presume he may have used his English the English language version of his name at work.
Yeah, I wonder. I'm not sure. I must look that up. He wouldn't have been as satirical.
Mm-hmm.
He was more of a poet that didn't really go for people the way Brian O'Nolan did.
Yeah.
So maybe, I don't know whether, maybe that's another one that we could look at and say, was he a softer writer?
For sure.
Because he was a civil servant.
And there's definitely a few. I mean, there were a few others, and that would have been the practice at the time, to either use a pen name or to use the English or Irish translation of your name.
Just like people do on Facebook when they become teachers now.
Yes.
What?
I think people, a lot of people assume that I'm a teacher because I have obviously my Irish name on Facebook.
Misuse of the Irish language.
In a way, it's almost like a code, but that still seems to have been relaxed in later years when we had more recent civil service writers like Dennis O'Driscoll and Donal Ryan most recently, who is no longer a civil servant. I believe he's a writer in residence in
Limerick, right?
In Limerick now.
Yeah,
so
good on him.
More power to him. Mm-hmm. And then I think it's definitely, if you read The Spinning Heart, you can definitely see how obviously his inside look in the civil service definitely gave him an insight into that.
Mm-hmm.
And Donal Ryan, fantastic writer,
a great writer, yeah.
So we'll have to have a quick word on the Irish language, obviously, and Flann. Obviously, the name Flann itself, meaning blood, also a warrior. Much like in certain Native American cultures, a blood was a warrior.
Mm-hmm.
Flann, and we may have mentioned this before in the podcast, in the Constitution, the version when they named the flag, the colours of the flag, it's Uinne, Bon Bon, August Flann Vui.
Yeah.
That, instead, rather than saying a Rashta,
we couldn't be using the Rosh.
Couldn't be saying a Rosh in the Constitution. Flann Vui, basically blood, yellow. The Bon d'Éireadh, some colours like Bon d'Éireadh are a combination of the two colours that constitute them. And similarly, Flann meaning red, a particular shade of red, and Vui meaning yellow.
Mm-hmm. Doth a Rosh to make.
Doth a Rosh to make, exactly. And interestingly enough, I suppose on that theme, the Kirkadurcha, which is the Gaeltacht area where And Bell booked the set that's basically eggplant purple or aubergine purple, because it's basically dark. Corcyra is purple and Dorcha is dark.
Yeah.
And that's obviously a reference to Corcyraena in Kerry.
Yeah.
Beautiful part of the world.
Beautiful part of the world, and an area in which Flann enjoyed taking the piss out of, especially within Tlánach, the island man, Tomás O'Crihan's great work about the last people of the Blasket Island.
We'll never see their like again.
We will never see their like again.
How does he say that in Irish again?
Mar na beg ar lehedi rishon. And that must be repeated maybe 100 times in Unbailbuch. It becomes absolutely hilarious, and it does become absurd very quickly. And I think you never look at Tlánach the same way again after you read Unbailbuch. And that's something that Unbailbuch does.
Yeah.
It actually colours how you read other texts in Irish. And sometimes I would actually have to say it has coloured my experience of the language, because at certain points in my life as what I call a Gaedagor Garamil, professional Gaedagor, I'm having the same conversations with people all the time, over and over and over again. And I just realise, my God, Flann O'Brien would be laughing about this. Like, I am living in Unbailbuch sometimes, trying to tell people that I am really Gaelic and Margo will my Gaelic, and I'm even more Gaelic than you are, and this is how we are going to save the language. So, you know, it actually has coloured how I look at the world at times, that book. And it's tiny. It's only maybe 60 pages.
I'd say it's one of the most accessible novellas in Irish, certainly of that scale. And it's definitely a good place to start if you are thinking of dipping your toe into reading a whole novel.
Yeah. And T.G. Cahir showed a cartoon version at Christmas this year.
That's right. I saw it. It was excellent.
Yeah, a short version.
And it was a very nice production.
It was beautifully produced, yeah.
And one of the things, one of the phrases that also pops up in Unbailbuch in relation to the satirised Gaelgóirí is the phrase bio agus glan, about the Irish language, meaning bio meaning living and glan meaning clean. The idea that the Irish must be living, but also must be pure.
There was a lot of that, yeah. And again, at the time when you look at the revival, the people who moved into this space of we should become more Gaelic, those who lived on the east looking to the west, they decided they were going to take on this as an aim, that we were going to become Gaelic. And to become Gaelic, we actually became, you know, it was kind of like a distilled version of what they wanted. They handpicked bits of the Gaelicus that they wanted.
Yeah.
You know, this beautiful woman in the west and Roisin as Ireland and all that. Whereas actually, when we go back in time and before anything happened in Ireland, when it was really Gaelic, the rules about being pure and conservative weren't there.
Yeah.
And in fact, things were a lot freer. We were a much more liberal society. But that's not the part that they wanted. They wanted, you know, we talk about comely maidens and De Valera, that kind of idea, that this would bring us a certain sense of self, but that it had to come with this caveat that it had to be very conservative.
Exactly. And that's the thing. It was, I think it's important to put De Valera's Dancing at the Crossroads speech in the context of other kind of sharp turns in traditionalism around Europe at the time. I often wonder, Sean, you know, I mean, Ireland before World War II, I mean, back in the old days, before Vatican II, before all these things, you know, most countries were somewhat conservative in their own way. But during World War II, there was or the emergency, as they called it.
Emergency.
The emergency, as we call it in Ireland.
I'd love to find out who came up with that term.
It possibly Flann, who knows. But one of the things I found was that historically, that was a time that lots of women entered the workforce. And that when the war was over, they didn't necessarily fancy going back. And that's when this was the big myth of the American housewife kind of came down in the 50s, when there was turmoil relating to men coming home and finding their role slightly usurped. But part of me wonders how much of is our neutrality in World War II responsible for all the misogyny and sexism that happened afterwards, that we didn't have the same feminist revolution at the same time? How much, well, I'm rambling here.
No, but I think you have a good point. I think before all of that happened, and well before all of that happened, the Irish culture and our native culture actually held women in a huge regard.
Yeah.
They were strong. You think of Grainne Whale, you think of the names that Ireland was.
Yeah.
And they were like warrior women, and they were out and they were going to do this, that and the other. And same even sexually. There was, even when I go to the Gaeltacht sometimes, And I talk to people in the Gaeltacht, and I'm trying not to other them here. There's a certain freedom in the way they talk about their bodies and the way they talk about sex that really doesn't match the same when I come back east and I talk to people of my own age even. There's a certain conservatism.
Yeah.
And I think the Irish language hides a lot of the rawness, if you know what I mean.
I think so. And a big thing is in English, and this is something that's one of the big differences between English and Irish, is you have, in English, you've got a polite word and a rude word for a body part or a body function. And we know this, say, whereas in languages that don't have that class system built into them, you just have the one word.
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't know whether it's because they're on the West Coast and they were further away from the Pale or whatever it is, I'm not sure. But I do feel like there's a certain wildness and I love it. And I wish that we could have more of it, because I just feel like, oh God, we're so bloody conservative at times. Why? Well, so that's one reason why I love the Irish language. And I think Flann also loved that there was a sense of more of an earthiness. That's what I'd call it, actually, rather than wild sexuality. They'd love that back in Corcoraine.
I think they would, but I think Flann may have, if we have only his writings to go on, he may have run a mile from it.
Yes, I think there's been a few comments made on Flann O'Brien's sexuality. He married later on in life. He married a woman called Evelyn, and I'm not really sure how the marriage went, to be honest. There's been certain comments made that he thought that he had to get married for tax reasons. I've read that in places. Which is way harsh on his poor wife. But he didn't live that long after he got married. And she certainly doesn't feature in any of his writings.
Yeah.
And when it comes to women, they're really not there.
There's not much love interest.
No.
Even in Bell Books, effectively, not unlike the reverse case of the Peg story, he gets married and then the next we hear of his wife is that she's dead.
Yeah. And there's not much sadness about it. It's like, move on.
Yeah.
In fact, one of the sexual passages actually is when he describes in great detail what a bike looks like.
Our producer Brian would love this.
Brian, do you like bikes?
Brian's very keen on cycling.
Well, Flann O'Brien loved a good bike, and the detail to which he described this bicycle was basically pornographic. But all other references to sex are basically omitted. They're not there.
Yeah, and how much of that is down to the censorship, censorship of the time? Bearing in mind now that Fat Swim was published in the United Kingdom, and so he can't blame Dev and his army of rubber stampers for that one.
No.
But how much is down to his own choice of what to write about, and how much it isn't? But certainly, if that's the kind of thing you're looking for, you won't find it in Flann.
You won't find it here.
Any last thoughts before we wrap up?
No, I think it's great that he's finally been acknowledged for the amazing writing that he did, and even recently Maeve Long's books on the letters. Like, that's another part that really hasn't been discovered yet. I did enjoy when the Irish Times republished a lot of the Cruiskeen Lawn over the last few years, and Frank McNally's really been heading up that in The Irishman's Diary.
Yeah.
But I think he's one of those people who we will always look back on and think, wow, we should have given him some more love when he was around.
We should, but the great thing about books is it's never too late.
It's never too late. Flann O'Brien is there for you.
On that note, Sian, Lucan, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
So, it's a slán for me.
And it's a slán mór for me.
See you next time. Hey gang, Derek here again. Just want to thank you so much for listening today. Hope you enjoyed the show. Our live show, as part of the International Literature Festival Dublin, is coming on the 24th of May in Smock Alley Theatre. We cannot wait to see you all. It's going to be a very fun night. Jam-packed, lots of surprises. There's still time to book tickets at ilfdublin.com. Motherfucker comes out every Friday on the Headstuff Podcast Network. Please do support our work by liking and sharing the podcast itself, giving us reviews on Apple, Stitcher, wherever you get them. And of course, tell your friends. If you enjoy this, do tell your friends. It means a lot. And I think word of mouth is the most powerful way to recommend things. Thanks to Brian for producing today. Thanks to Kirsten Shield for doing the artwork. If you're looking for a new show to listen to, the Head Stuff Podcast Network has got some great ones waiting for you. A very topical one at the moment is The Eighth, which deals with topics concerning the current referendum in great depth and with great feeling. It's well worth checking out. And also do consider checking out Juvenalia. It was the first podcast I ever did, was as a guest in Juvenalia, and they put on a great show. They just talk about a piece of pop culture that's very important to an interesting person. Give it a go. If you want to contact the show, please contact the Twitter handle Motherfucklore, or at the Irish Four, or motherfucklore@headstuff.org if you're old-fashioned and you enjoy sending an email. Until the next time, slán.
This has been a production of the Headstuff Podcast Network.
It is binoculars. ILFD.com
I think you're right.